Yeah.
I'm Ram.
I'm E.
And I'm Def C.
The golem wakes, closes fist, folds a face. Opposing army soldiers shake, all retreat, no escape. Open space in front lines, unwinds, chokes and breaks. Any troop of fools who was stupid enough to roam his way. Bastard child of Superman and Frankenstein's creature. Sanctified slang out of gray and white speaker. Created by the ether, super ugly and horrific. Covered in resilience and the dust of deliverance.
The golem kept you safe, Babylonia to Poland. The golem's been the same since the moment it was molded. The golem smelled hatred, the golem left it broken. World stays world, the golem stays the golem. The golem kept you safe, Babylonia to Poland. The golem's been the same since the moment it was molded. The golem smelled hatred, the golem left it broken. World stays world, the golem stays the golem.
Welcome to the next movement, and welcome back, Def C. Glad to have you back.
Yes,
man, I'm happy to be back. As I said before we got started, our conversation about "Save Yourself" by Lucid is probably one of my favorite conversations I've had about music, whether it's on or off the mic. So, I just wanted to show you guys that love on the mic as well. Thank you very much for offering me the opportunity to do that, and also engaging with an incredibly and intensely written page of notes as well, or pages of notes rather.
Yes.
That was a lot of fun though. I appreciate you guys.
Yeah, no, yeah, we enjoyed that as well. Thank you.
Yeah.
We appreciated your preparedness. That was appreciated also.
Yeah. I mean, it deserved it, right? I feel like anytime I'm talking about people like Woods or Lucid, I have to come to the table with, you know, having done the knowledge on things that they refer to, things that they rap about, and then at the very least get the words right, you know?
Yeah, right.
I feel like there are so many times where, you know, the brilliance of what they do as writers gets lost in, you know, when people mistranscribe things on Genius or whatever. So it was good to be able to sit down and at least be able to sort out those thoughts for myself, in addition to being able to share them with you guys. So
yeah, definitely. Appreciate that. For sure. Well, a lot has happened since the last time we spoke to you. You've released an EP with August Fanon. Let's see, All Debts, Public and Private, Trap Door, probably missing. Oh, the Def Prez album that is not even that old at this point. And unfortunately, I don't know that we're going to have time to talk about any of those things tonight, because we really want to talk to you about this new project you got coming, The Golem of Brooklyn. There's just so much about this project that's fascinating to me. It's been difficult to know where to start. It's such a unique album. I've struggled to think of anything else quite like it. Sky Zoo's project from earlier this year, The Mind of Saint, comes to mind, you know, based around Snowfall, a TV show, and the characters.
Which, you know, I just, not to interrupt, but just to say, like, that was the reference point that Adam Mansbach gave me when we initially started talking about putting something like this together and saying it could be this, but it doesn't have to be.
Yeah.
Which was really dope. Anyway, I'm sorry, continue.
Oh, that's cool. I mean, I like knowing that. Yeah, but it's that, but it's not that, right? This is a rap album based around a novel, which is based around Jewish folklore and culture and history. I've never heard anything like this. And I think maybe it'd be good to start by gaining some context. So, you know, as we're talking about, the project is meant to be a companion to the book of the same name written by Adam Mansbach, who some people might know from his children's book for adults, Go the Fuck to Sleep. But I'm wondering if you'd be willing to give us a brief overview from your perspective, what the book is about, your reactions to the book, and how you ended up getting involved.
I've known Adam since I was a teenager. So he used to do, I think, through Young Chicago Authors. I also have a vague memory, or at least that's what he's been saying, because I don't really remember when we met. But the first time that I actually recall having a conversation with him, I was at the University of Wisconsin, going to college as a part of the First Wave scholarship program. And so he was brought up there, and that was the first time I met him. And then from there, was like, you know, everything he did, I feel like I was hearing his name every other day after I met him. You know, you had Rage Is Back, you had Go the F to Sleep, and all of the books that came after it, which was like, you know, you have Samuel L. Jackson reading your book on The Tonight Show out loud, and it hits number one bestseller in the New York Times. Like, everything I saw. And he also was like a very, I noticed, harsh critic of hip hop. Like, he had no problem calling anything whack, and I always respected that. He also had a mean roast game. Like, back when I was on Facebook, I could never tell. He was like very, he would pick his spots, but he used to roast me on Facebook. I can't even lie. But yeah, he's an incredibly talented guy. He's a genius. I read the book. He sent the book to me. Like, I think he sent me a Twitter DM or something about him having an idea. He sent me the PDF of the book. This is before it's even a galley. Like there's still, I think it still had some copy editing to go through. And I read it in a day. I fell in love with it. I really felt like I had never, as a man, this is a phrase I think I'm going to have to get used to saying, that does not. So as a Jewish millennial, I don't think I've ever related to a novel or a story like that one, where the setting was very contemporary. So were the conversations, the reference points were all rooted in a lot of Jewish folklore and mythology that I think a lot of kids who grow up going to synagogues and having parents who observed Passover and Hanukkah and Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, like a lot of that kind of mythology and folklore that we're raised with, really. I've always been interested in golems as well, just because it's, you know, essentially the origins for Superman. You know what I mean? I'm a big superhero fan, so really being interested in that. And then, you know, the stories my dad told me growing up, like to help me go to sleep when I'm a little kid. And just all of that tying together and coming to the forefront of what I was thinking about when I first read the book, it was like, it's a no-brainer. This can't just be like a song, you know? I'd recorded an entire second album's worth of material that isn't even going on this, that we're going to hold for something else down the line. But yeah, I mean, that's how I know Adam. That's how I got involved with the book. That's how I got involved with the project. But yeah, I mean, I really hope people go out and read it. It's an incredible book. I'd be saying that even if I didn't do the album for it, because the book was so good that I spent months procrastinating, like just kind of feeling a lot of pressure about making sure that what I did lived up to the standard that the book set.
Where did the idea come from? I mean, I think it's a rather unique idea, like a soundtrack as a companion for a novel. Was that the idea, like, initially when he contacted you, or did that just come about through conversation about the book?
It was initially, it was like, this could be a song. This could be a project or an EP or whatever. I think he was thinking of something much more short form.
Okay.
And then after reading the book and falling in love with it, that was the point at which I was like, okay, this has to be an album. Like, there's just so much to talk about here.
Yeah.
Because I think his book is it's a very well-paced read. There's a lot of action, a lot of humor. It's really enjoyable, but it's also very dense in terms of a lot of the things he's addressing in the book. So, yeah, I mean, it was an album for me right away. And it was like Messiah Music is the producer right away. I think I floated a few names past him, but yeah, a book called The Golem of Brooklyn, and I'm gonna do a soundtrack about it. I'm calling him Messiah. Like, that's A, the name, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And B, a remarkably talented person whose music is so, he's just one of the best in the world at what he does. And I'm fortunate enough to be able to work with him. So that's how it all came together.
And what was the process like? Like, are you referencing the book frequently while you're writing? Do you feel like you're writing just from the perspective of the characters or out of the narrative of the book, or some of this, like, your twist on it?
That's interesting. I think for me, there's a constant, like, shifting of perspective, right? So, like, there's a song from the perspective of Len. There's a song from the perspective of the bodega cat, Adolfo, right? But then there are songs about events in the book. But when I actually sat down and really started thinking about it and, like, taking notes, making lists, listening to things, watching stuff, it was then that I realized that I, you know, like it couldn't just be about the book. There had to be something else involved. Like I had to address other stuff. I couldn't just talk about things in the book. And I also felt a little bit like if it was too one-to-one, like if I was making a song about every chapter or something like that, it wouldn't have felt like something I would be good at doing. But he gave me a lot of freedom. We were constantly texting and talking, probably on a close to, if not actually daily basis, just throwing ideas. If I did demos, texted them to him. And then I took a long time procrastinating, to be honest with you. Like, I think most of the songs on the album, if not all of them, were written in like a 2 to 3 month period, maybe. Like when I went on the summer vacation from my job in late June. No, I'm lying. In early June, and then probably wrapped everything up like second to last week of August. So it was a really, like the actual creation and production of material was a relatively short window of time, but I spent so much time just fully understanding what this opportunity meant and also the significance of the subject matter and things I felt needed to be addressed or deserved to be addressed. This was a venue for me to be able to, you know, actually start to have those conversations. I apologize about, I live right on a busy street, so let me know if you need me to move or anything.
So how much was Adam actually involved in the creative process? Did he contribute ideas in terms of the direction?
Absolutely. So he contributed ideas as far as like song concepts, things to write about. I sent him the massive pack of beats that Messiah sent me. And initially I was just sending them to him like, hey, Adam, like, just let me know which ones you like. I'm thinking like a rapper, right? And he winds up writing a paragraph about each of the beats and sending it to me as like a Word document. And Messiah is so good at what he does that he sent Adam a bunch of stuff that Adam loved immediately that he felt connected with the material in the novel. So, but yeah, that was like, there was a lot of note-taking involved. There was a lot of asking Adam questions, running ideas by him. You know, I would like send screenshots of things as I was working on them, if I was writing them on my phone or in Google Docs, or even on some occasions, like writing it down on paper just to ask and make sure I was headed in the right direction. He was very involved, very, very deeply involved in the process, because I wasn't gonna take his concept, run off and just figure it out. Like, he needed to be a part of it in order for it to be a good reflection of his work and just a good song too.
Yeah.
Or a good record, I'm sorry. Yeah. Like a good album as well.
You mentioned Messiah Music. How important was it to work with a single producer?
I felt like it was pretty important, right? Like, I think films have scores. So It felt right if I was doing a soundtrack for something to just do it with the one producer, if I was going to be the only artist on a soundtrack, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that's why it was important, was just what I knew of the format and what I was trying to do with the concept.
I think you kind of answered this already, but how did the characters and the story being told in this book shape the sound of the soundtrack?
I mean, there definitely was an aesthetic that, in terms of the book, that stylistically I kind of felt like this could only be Messiah, right? So the variations in mood. Also, just the idea of a golem. I think of Messiah's drums, right? Like the golem's footsteps, or like the golem throwing a punch and connecting, or like it was just, I could hear Messiah's production style in the language of the book and in the story that was being told. And also knowing that like Messiah and I have had conversations about being white Jewish guys in this industry before, or not this industry, but like who make hip hop music before, and that we have had really tough conversations as well about, you know, like, how seriously do you take somebody like Ye when he says something crazy on a podcast, right? Mm. Like something pro-Hitler or anti-Semitic. Like, how personally can we take that for a variety of reasons? Reason one being he's appears to me, and I'm not a professional, to be going through something mentally that's so he may not know exactly what it is he's saying or believe it. And B, the worst thing somebody like Kanye can do to Jews in the United States is hurt our feelings. You know, the impact of what he said, it felt like it maybe validated things that are kind of like centuries old conspiracy theories that people have about Jewish people. Mm-hmm. Or things that certainly, like, when you have a negative experience with white people in the music industry and those white people are mostly Jewish, like, you're going to feel a way about it, I think.
Yeah.
So it's not, I'm trying to think of a way to put this that's not heartless or cold, because it still hurts to hear that. It still hurts to hear somebody that you revere and admire say that somebody who had massacred 6 million people because they were Jewish like you had some sort of validity, let alone the entire 10 million people that Hitler massacred in Germany. Like, it's hard for me to look at somebody who I used to respect and admire to hear them say something like that and it not be hurtful, at least a little bit.
Sure.
So I don't want to be dismissive of that, which I'm appreciative. Somebody actually called me out for that on Twitter at a different time. But, you know, Dan and I talk about stuff like that all the time. So it's a deep, these are deep conversations that we have. It makes sense that if there are deep conversations that are going to be had in the music, he would be the person to provide the soundscape for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
When I think of a soundtrack in a traditional sense, it's an extension of a given film, right? But it's also used as a promotional tool to get people hype about watching said movie. So if part of that was the goal making this project, how did that inform the creative approach that you took?
I wasn't, you know, what's interesting is I like really was not sure what kind of soundtrack I was going to make before I started making it. So like, if I recall correctly, like, there have been film soundtracks and where there's been like, there have been songs on the soundtrack, like the Batman Forever soundtrack, right? Like, Method Man has a whole song, I think, either from the perspective of or about the Riddler, but there are also songs on that soundtrack that were not about Batman or any of the sort of characters related to them. So I think I was trying to figure out how I could do a blend of those. And then at a certain point, like, based on the feedback I was getting from Adam, it became pretty readily apparent that the stuff that was the most compelling was the stuff that was based around events from or characters who were in the book. So I just kind of went, you know, we just kind of went with that. And definitely this came out looking much different from how I'd initially envisioned it, for sure. And also shout out to Boathouse, who mixed, mastered, engineered the whole project, did a lot of like last minute edits on the road, like literally in a car on his way back from visiting family. And Alex at Close Sessions, DJ RTC, who really did everything he could in the midst of a lot of different personal life transitions to make sure that people were going to hear this album, and also to make sure that it was actually going to be good by the time people heard it. Because I had envisioned this being a double album. I'd envisioned this being 26 songs. I envisioned it being, and at a certain point, I was in the studio with Boathouse, and Boathouse was like, look, man, you have like 12 songs done plus all of these others. Just stop. Like, he didn't say it like that, right? He is one of the kindest, most genuine people ever. So he didn't say it like that. But essentially it was like 10 to 12 songs. Like, let's just see what we got, put it together. So it was also, I think, the strongest collection of music that was reflective of the novel. You know, we can always figure out what to do. I like the other songs a lot too, but, you know, we're going to figure out what to do with them soon, and people will hear those too.
Yeah, I'm curious to see what happens.
Yeah, me too.
So the main character in The Golem of Brooklyn is a high school art teacher named Lynn Bronstein. Maybe people call him Lenny. You share this profession with him, and you have also named that you relate to Lynn in other ways too. Do you think that connecting with the characters and the story in general was an important and an essential part of making the soundtrack.
Absolutely. 1,000%. If I think about who I am as a person, as a teacher, in terms of appearance, in terms of the way, like, Len Bronstein is probably one of the most accurate parallels in terms of in terms of people that I've seen, like, show up with, you know, obviously with some exceptions. Yeah, obviously with some exceptions, but he in particular, being able to relate to the protagonist was particularly important to me. And also there being a protagonist, as people will see in the novel, who's kind of the butt of most of, if not all of the jokes. Like, typically, I think we see kind of that protagonist or that kind of hero in a story as the person who is going to save the day. And, you know, it's not, that's not Len. There is nothing about Len that screams traditional hero. Or if he even is a hero or just somebody who happened to do the right, you know, cast the right spells at the right time. But yeah, it was important for me to be able to relate to him so that A, I could use whatever insight I have from my personal life to fuel the music I was writing, and B, just because if, you know, if I feel like even if you're a loser like Len is, right, if you're at least likable, then there's material to work with. And so in order to, I related to the character, I liked the character, and so made it easy to be able to then take on the project of turning the novel into music.
Yeah, I imagine that when you make that connection, the creativity just flows.
Yeah, absolutely. But when you guys read the novel, I think you will understand why I am not, that is not, what? How am I trying to say this? I am not trying to big myself up making that comparison. There is no bragging.
Okay.
You will see very quickly. He's a very, like, not super crazy, off the wall, like, Frank Miller flawed, but like just a flawed dude who keeps getting put in situations where he's got to be a hero, but he's just incapable of doing it. So
I can't wait to read it.
Yeah, it's good. It's really good.
I'm just picturing you getting stoned in your living room trying to build a 9-foot tall clay figure.
Well, no, you know, I don't do that for any students or potential school district administrators who may be listening to this podcast. I know nothing about any of that.
That's right.
And B, you know, that is a hilarious image. And also, I've, you know, already put in my bid to Adam. I was like, when this is inevitably turned into a movie, I just want an audition.
Yeah.
I just want an audition. I don't even need the role. I don't want it. I don't even know if I have time for it. But, you know, it's a really good book. I connected with it in a lot of ways. And to be able to have such a deeply flawed character involved in so much of the story and still having moments of wisdom throughout, or moments of lucidity and common sense, I think that that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So reminded me a little bit of myself, maybe in lower moments of my life as a teacher.
So I was pleasantly surprised to hear Bobbito's voiced on Hipster Kebab, because I didn't know that he was on it before he made his entrance. What led to him being on the project, and why was it important for his voice to be heard on the soundtrack?
I think that was Adam Mansbach reaching out. I know Adam was around the New Eurekan and like its glory days, late 90s, early 2000s. And also just, I think he thought, okay, we're doing this thing about a bodega cat. And then Bobbito Garcia was the first person who popped into his head. So he reached out to Bobbito. I know that Adam and I had been spitballing different features potentially that just didn't work out, mainly because they didn't fit the music that was about to go on the soundtrack. But I'm very, very fortunate and grateful that Adam reached out to Bobbito, and also grateful to Bobbito for lending his voice to the project, because that dude's a hero of mine. I think he's a hero of all of ours, right? So like,
yeah,
you know, and was the voice of a lot of our underground hip hop days. So to be able to have him on the project, I was just really grateful for that. And I can't take any credit for it. It was all Adam Mann's back.
He's perfect. It's perfect to feature him on this project.
Yeah, agreed. And also, so that was the other thing too, right? Is like, I'm not from Brooklyn. I've visited Brooklyn a handful of times in my life, maybe not even a handful, but I'm not from Brooklyn. So it was also important to be able to have like a New Yorker involved in some capacity.
Right.
Yeah.
Because I'm from the suburbs of Chicago, Messiah's in Baltimore, the label's in Chicago. Like,
yeah,
it was good to be able to have Bob Beato involved as a part of it. And he also was like just the most natural fit for the project. I feel like it feels right that he's the only feature, even though, you know.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense.
I was legit happy for you when he said your name. Here's Bob Beato saying your name. It's wild.
Yo, I got the Dropbox link, and I was not expecting him to say Def C at all. I was like, this could be purely Bob Beato's voice is on the same song as mine. That's enough for me. And then when he shouted me out, it was definitely that for sure.
Yeah.
It was really cool. It was a dope moment.
There are two other tracks on the album that I want to ask about. Knights of Broken Glass and Confederate Flags in Tel Aviv.
Southern Cross is flying in Zion like a semaphore. We can't say that I'm Jewish, not white anymore. Claim to be forthright, yet jumped at the chance to captain the Fourth Reich in the matter of a fortnight. It's a metaphor. We chose flight and could have built something beautiful from the ground up. Instead, we decided we ain't like having black or brown people around us. Redlining God's country, busting blocks with bulldozers. Cold world, we sheared fat from the land for a war pullover that we never slid past our faces. Enraged if someone justifiably calls us racist. Many of us became who we hid from in basements. Leo Frank lynched on a postcard. Goodman and Schwerner buried with Cheney, so we asked for a gold star when the question is, what have we done for you lately? Blind eye to non-white immigrants we won't allow to be Israeli. We should open up the books, instead we get cagey. Compare the Holocaust to slavery and align ourselves with the same people who are compromising our safety.
They're tracks that really pull no punches, pretty blunt descriptions of both anti-Semites and Jewish people who maybe don't live up to their own expectations for how they should be treated. And I've imagined that writing these two songs may have been challenging, that it may have felt like a delicate process. I've also imagined, and I know you told us a little bit about this off mic, but I've also imagined they could lead to some backlash. So I'm wondering, like, as you were writing them, how much you considered how the two groups you're writing about may have reacted to the lyrics.
Well, Knights of Broken Glass is based on a scene in the book.
Okay.
So there's a scene in the book where basically the events of Knights of Broken Glass are taking that and running with it. But when it comes to, I mean, caring about what white supremacists think of me or anti-Semitic people or people who don't like Jews, like, your opinion never mattered in the first place because you're an asshole. And if you're not willfully ignorant, there's something evil about you that you got to work on. So I'm not, like, I don't really care about hurting a racist's feelings or an anti-Semite's feelings. Like, I'm just not, you know? My feelings about writing Confederate Flags in Tel Aviv are a bit more complicated, obviously, because the thing that I think we've been quick to do in the past as far as a Jewish community is to take a look at anybody who's being publicly critical of the community and to call them like a self-hating Jew, or to imply that, like, you know, essentially some sort of like self-hatred in general, or like insecurity about being Jewish, wanting to be. But like, at this point in the American experiment, we as Jewish people, especially people around my age and younger, have never really known. I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this delicately. Like, we don't have any context for a time when anti-Semitism had systemic consequences in the United States. right? Like, because most of us are white, we've subscribed to and have fully assimilated into white America. And yet there is this constant refusal to acknowledge where we have not shown up in accordance with what are, in my opinion, the most noble values that we were raised with. So I think of things like Tikkun Olam and Sadaka, so healing the world, charity. I think of things like the Golden Rule. There's the story about Hillel, Rabbi Hillel, who is challenged to explain the entire Torah while standing on one foot. And he picks up the Torah, he stands on one foot and says, do not do unto your neighbors as you would not want done to you. The rest is just commentary, and then puts his foot down, right? Like, that's it. Like, stories like that, that's what it means to be Jewish to me. And I think that there are a lot of, unfortunately, a lot of people in the Jewish community who, whether they're conscious of it or not, value being white and wealthy and powerful more than they do those values. And I think that that hurts me. And it especially hurts me when I'm thinking about, like, people who I grew up with, people who I grew up around, who are not willing to have conversations. They're willing to have conversations, for example, about being white Americans of that nature, but conversations about what the state of Israel or the Israeli government has been doing to the Palestinian community for quite some time, or don't want to acknowledge the amount of conservative politicians who have been funded, unfortunately, by Jewish donors. Not like most of them have done it. Not like, again, it's where I'm not talking about protocols of the Elders of Zion, where everybody's getting together for an ice cream social in Switzerland, you know, once every 4 years to decide who gets elected president. But I'm saying, like, as a Jewish person, it hurts me that we can't even talk about it. It doesn't even have to be conversation necessarily about, like, it does have to be a conversation about all the ways in which we've messed up, because we've benefited from institutional racism and now, like, imperialism and colonialist attitudes in Israel and here in support of Israel. Yeah, it's just, the song was easy to write, but it's, as I'm thinking about it more and more, it's become difficult for me to talk about or even think about, because the one thing that I don't want anybody to think after listening to this song is that I hate being Jewish, or I hate myself because I'm Jewish, or I hate Jewish people.
Yeah.
Because it's not the case. I am who I am today because I have Jewish family who loved me and positive morals that were based on those principles of being Jewish. And so I never want anybody to think that I hate Jewish people or hate being Jewish or sick of us refusing to have these tough conversations, opportunity to have them. We just kind of assimilate people who actually want to destroy us. Yeah. I mean, I think that that's ultimately everything that's at the heart of Confederate flags in Tel Aviv.
I really appreciate that.
Yeah.
Honest and complete answer. For what it's worth, the song to me sounds far less accusatory and more like a lament, you know, which I think conveys some of the feeling or emotion that you were just talking about. So, you know, it's my hope that most people pick up on that.
I hope so, too. And the title of the song came from, there's this picture that went viral that has since disappeared from social media and the internet. But there was a picture of somebody walking through Tel Aviv during a pro-right-wing protest wearing a Confederate flag and an Israeli flag yarmulke. And I think part of the urgency of the song, too, was just thinking to myself, like, say this is photoshopped or a deep fake, or somebody took a picture out of context and applied it to a situation that it did not actually belong to, right? Like, somebody took a random picture of somebody posing like that with that stuff on and said it was during a protest in Tel Aviv. That shouldn't even be thinkable.
Right.
That should be unconscionable. That shouldn't be acceptable in any way, shape, or form. The fact that it's believable means that there's something really wrong that we need to start talking about. And it starts with whiteness and white supremacy and how it shows up in white people in the Jewish community. Just, we're not exempt. Like, we gotta have these conversations. We have to. And so, you know what? I think it is a lament. I think it is a lament. It's not a letter to the editor, you know?
Right.
Yeah. I see this as you holding your community accountable, and you should be able to do that.
Yeah, I agree. But, you know, I think there's also an element of the Jewish community that's afraid that any fissure, any friction presented to the outside world is going to be exploited in order to destroy the Jewish community. And there's historical precedent to support that. So, like, yeah. I understand, and that also generational trauma is very real.
Sure.
And there are still so many families that have descended from people who survived the Holocaust or who didn't survive the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
So I understand, I deeply understand and empathize with the desire to not outwardly show weakness and to show that unity, yeah. But like, we're building with the wrong people.
Right.
Like we're seeking solidarity with people who they don't really like us. They don't really value us.
Yeah.
And they want us gone too. We just so happen to be the additional bodies or, you know, whomever has the power and resources. Like we just so happen to be in a useful position for those people right now.
Yeah.
But the minute that we outlive our usefulness, they're going to turn on us too. So,
yep. I feel all of that. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
That got way deeper than I thought it was going to get. So thank you guys for allowing me the breathing room to talk it out.
Yeah, no,
thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, thank you for your honesty.
Yeah, no doubt.
When you think about the Golem of Brooklyn, why and how do you think hip hop helps tell this story more so than any other genre of music could?
Adam Mansbach has done music projects related to his novels before. So when Rage Is Back, which is about a graffiti writer, came out, he did a mixtape with J Period. Black Thought was rhyming on there. It was like just a crazy guest list, remixes, freestyles, all of that. So, I mean, Adam is a hip hop head, like to his core. I'm talking from like, I first heard hip hop when I was 3 years old, and Adam was a hip hop head probably before I was born. That connection is that significant. So anything Adam is going to be involved in, I know, is going to have some element of hip hop present in it, because that doesn't really show up in the book. There are moments, there are like little inflections, and there are like things that are hip hop related for sure, but it's not really a prominent feature of the book. But come on, man, like my favorite rapper of all time, which I know we're going to talk about, is Sean Price. And Sean Price, if I think of the Golem of Brooklyn as in somebody who's going to be wild, tough, still smart, how is that not Sean Price? That's Sean Price. That's Sean Price all day, every day. And I think that there are other rappers I feel that way about too. Ill Bill from Nonfiction is somebody else I feel that way about. Lady of Rage, I feel that way about Lady of Rage, right? Or Beanie Siegel, like just these rappers who their presence was so large when they got on a song that you knew not to mess with them. Like that's what a golem, like I feel like a golem would be, is somebody who's in that mold. So that to me is what made it hip hop for sure. And it takes place in Brooklyn.
Yeah, like, right. Yeah. How did creating this project make you examine your own method of storytelling as an MC?
I had to learn to not hate it when I did it. Like it was a matter of like, I would write these songs and especially the ones that were based on elements of the book, you know, I wanted to make sure it wasn't corny or forced, or like, I wanted to make sure everything was natural. Right. I wanted like my main goal and the thing that was, I think, blocking me creatively for a long time was I knew that these songs had to be enjoyable independent of the book or even your understanding of the book. And so I had to get very good at telling stories without it feeling like it was a Dr. Seuss knockoff. You know, like I really wanted to make sure that I did the songs and the material justice to the extent where they can be reflective of the book, but your knowledge of the book doesn't have to be essential to enjoy the music, you know?
So it sounds like the Gollum of Brooklyn inspired you to write an album about being white and Jewish, and that's something that you've been wanting to do for a while. Could you say more about that? What story did you want to specifically tell by examining these two identities?
I just wanted to be honest, you know? I just wanted to be open and vulnerable in ways that maybe I haven't been in the past in my music. And this sparked it. It's a great work of literature. It inspired me to create something that I think I'd always known I wanted to make in the back of my mind, but never really knew if I could execute it with any kind of sincerity, right? Without coming across as corny. So yeah, I was just, again, like, I think the thing I keep coming back to is gratitude. I'm just eternally grateful that Adam asked me to be a part of it, that Messiah like took on this burden of sending me hundreds of beats while his wife is in her third trimester, and then baby is born, he's still sending me beats, baby's a newborn, and still taking care of business, still working his 9 to 5, still being a great dad, still being a great partner. Like, Messiah really did a lot of very hard work to make sure that this was gonna turn out well. And Alex did as well, as two young kids. So RTC really worked hard and hustled to make sure this was done, and Boathouse did too. I mean, this was a labor of love for all involved. So I'm grateful for everything that was a part of the process of making this album, with the exception of the overthinking and procrastination.
From what I've read about the book, because we haven't read the book yet, book comes out. Is it the 26th of September the book is released? Is that right?
Yeah, it's the 26th, because the album drops the 29th.
Okay. So from what I've read about the book, and you kind of alluded to this earlier, seems to be several different messages for both Jewish people and non-Jewish people alike. I'm wondering what you may have learned during the process of reading this book and creating the soundtrack, and what you hope people will take from it.
I mean, what I learned from the book was I'm not alone in thinking the way that I think. I think that's one thing. Another was that Jewish people do not necessarily have to be these stereotypes in order to be present in literature, even as, like, you know, like the Nebuchadnezzar Jewish guy, like the Seth Rogen kind of Jewish guy, right? Or the Jonah Hill kind of Jewish character that shows up in films, like, doesn't always have to look like that. Sometimes it just looks like a middle-aged teacher who got stoned and decided to do something incredibly stupid that winds up leading him on this, you know, on this adventure. Anyway, I got far afield from the question. Yeah, I hope people take away that I'm open-minded and willing to listen. And also, I hope that I'm able to help people better understand the nuances in navigating those identities. And also that, you know, like, guilt or shame does not have to be a stopping point. At a certain point, it has to turn into action. So I hope people take that away from what it is I said in there too. And yeah, I learned that I could make music in a much different way that I'm used to without feeling like I was selling myself short in some way, shape, or form. I feel like if I was able to get something like this done, then I could pretty much tackle anything. Concept albums are the hardest. I never thought I would be able to make one. I was able to make one. I learned I was capable of doing it. And also, I also learned a little bit about immediacy too. Like, a lot of these songs were written at the coffee shop across the street from the studio before the session. And I just would write until the song was done. So I also learned how to work under pressure and shoot from the hip.
This project was my introduction to a Gollum. I had no idea what a Gollum was before. Okay. No idea. So I did a little research because I wanted to understand more about what it is. And so I came across the following description. A creature formed out of a lifeless substance such as dust or earth that is brought to life by ritual incantations and sequences of Hebrew letters. The Gollum, brought into being by a human creator, becomes a helper, a companion, or a rescuer of an imperiled Jewish community. I don't know if I have a complete understanding still, but when I think about this description, it kind of reminds me of the role hip hop culture has played within disenfranchised communities. So when you consider the origins of hip hop, what inspired its creation, and the roots that allowed for its foundation. It has served as a rescuer, a helper. All the elements have been used as outlets to help folks manage trauma and express their frustrations. They've also been used to fight oppressive systems. But then you also have to consider the other characteristics of a golem, which are described on The Golem Speaks. In some tellings, the golem might be a heroic savior. In others, he might be an uncontrollable monster, adultish brute, even a tragic lover. I think that can also be true about hip hop culture, specifically the toxicity that exists within it. So if you think about your relationship with hip hop, right, in this context, how has the culture helped you navigate and manage the world around you? And when has it been harmful?
Wow. Wow. So first of all, I just need a minute to process all of that brilliant shit you just said, because that was wow. Yeah, I almost feel like any answer I give is not gonna live up to it.
There's no wrong answers.
I'll keep it simple. Yeah, I mean, yes, there are. When the question is that good, yes, there are. I think each one teach one from hip hop, from the 5% Nation. But I found that stuff through hip hop. The idea of education and mentorship as pathways to a better life or a more fulfilling life. I think those are things I took away from hip hop. And also just like nobody owed, like, I'm a white rapper, right? I don't think anybody owes me anything.
Yeah.
And I've been so fortunate to have people see something in me and still decide to pull me into the cypher or pull me close to them and nourish whatever they saw in me that was good or great. And it was rap first, and then it was my qualities as a human being after that, you know, because rap was the easy way to connect. So just paying that forward, you know, like I think my experiences with hip hop, I've been very fortunate to be around a lot of older practitioners of the craft who are also passionate about passing it on to the next generation. So I think that idea of community and, you know, I don't know what it's like to actually be marginalized, so I can't speak from that perspective. But to feel like it and to be insecure and have such little self-esteem or self-respect that I felt like nobody would care about me, but to be still be welcomed into a space and have a way to vent that frustration in a healthy way, like, that's something that I try to do for other people. If I can do that for other people, I want to do that for other people, because nobody owed me that. I never expected it coming in. And then just in terms of, I think a lot of my personal growth when it comes to how I look at the world has come from questioning the things that drew me to hip hop. So I think like some of the ways in which black and brown people are stereotyped with hip hop used to do it, I think that that having to unlearn that was something that was really important, but that wasn't a hip hop thing. That was a music industry thing. And that's the other thing too. I can't really think of anything that's inherent to hip hop culture that's toxic in a different way than anything inherent to like American culture or white American culture. So I think that I don't know that hip hop is what introduced me to that, you know? Like I think I've been guilty of it for sure, but I don't think that that's because of hip hop. I think that's because I'm a white man in America. And I'm not trying to put that on anybody else. It's on me, but I don't, I would never look at hip hop as the thing that did that, you know?
That was a great answer.
That
was a great answer, by the way.
Thank you.
All right. I think it might be time to switch it up a bit.
Yeah. But thank you guys, man. This is like a therapy session. I feel like I should get an invoice after this.
Hey yo, we mighty Joe, dungin' it. Straight from the jungle, my brother, my niggas, banana Republican. Ring a tang, slang, Chewbacca, not rocker. Two socks full of rocks, plus the cops watches. Yo, we smoke weed, pop pills, drink liquor. We do the knowledge, read lessons, think quicker. My little niggas saying that the boot camp whack. Fuck you, Pa, you can't rap. Listen, let it be known. Stepping on rose petals led to the throne. I'm the motherfucking king, getting head from this hole. In the hood, new estate in Jersey with Jay Williams, drinking Amstel Light, shooting that clay pigeon. Y'all niggas is straight timid, delicate with the raps. My niggas are spray midgets, elephants on their back. Yo. You kidding me, Duke? Walk around like that, you ain't strapped, give me your loot. Sean, something like a motherfucking phenomenon. Eat your food at noon, celebrating Ramadan. Hey, yo, big barbarians, baboons with big bucks, gorillas with gats, nigga, big rock. African apes who stacking their babes. I put some crack in your steak, don't get slapped in the face.
For the listeners out there, if you're new to the show, every episode we ask our guests to pick an album that is either a favorite or has been influential or is a personal classic, something like that. And then we spend the second segment of our show discussing said album. We're going to do that tonight. And the main focus is going to be on, I think, is going to be on Sean Price and Monkey Bars. We may also spend some time talking a little bit about Nonfiction and Ill Bill, as Def C has alluded to earlier.
Yeah.
But let's start with Monkey Bars.
Yes.
As you have made plain, you've made clear, Sean Price, number one.
Favorite rapper ever.
Favorite rapper.
I know more P verses than I do like Big and Pac verses.
Okay.
Being honest.
A true hardcore fan. Why Monkey Bars over other Sean P records?
I think there's a little bit more to talk about. You know, like there's more to unpack there. I think that I love Mike Tyson, man. Mike Tyson's a great album, and it's probably more Golem-esque than Monkey Bars is.
Yeah.
But I think when people talk about P, there are like things, when I went back and revisited the album the other day, there are things about P that people that wasn't as present in the music he made after Monkey Bars that show up here that I really loved and respected. So things like in Heartburn, like he'll say something like, I love selling Nicks at night. And then the next bar is go home to my son, roll a spliff and watch Nick at night. Or like say something crazy off the wall. Like, I love mushrooms. I love the Puff Boom. And then he'll say something like, I love to live. What is it? I love living with you, though. It ain't much room. Like, that's such a, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
I think that kind of stuff always really spoke to me. And just this album. I mean, I like the title track is one of my favorite rap songs ever. Like, just how does somebody rap that well for 2.5 verses, and then to get to the last verse and just be like, all right, cool, I got 2 bars of a 12 syllable rhyme scheme, I'm done. You know, like, I think that there are just some things about, yeah, I love it, man. I love that album a lot. There are a lot of things about it that have not aged well.
Yeah,
a lot of things about it that have not aged well. Yeah. There's one song in particular with Buckshot called Bye Bye. That song is like, there's also a song that has a title, I Love You, B Word, which is also not aged well either. But there are moments in it that seem to be a bit more earnest and like kind hearted. Bye Bye is not any of those things. But yeah, anyway, I just love Sean Price. I really love this album. Yeah, I'll leave it there as to why Monkey Bars. I think it's just more reflective of who he was as a person, as opposed to, you know, just the side that punched people through school buses, you know?
Yeah, you do somehow get like the vulnerable, like flashes of vulnerability amidst the badassery. It's unique in that way, I think. What are your earliest memories of listening to this album?
I remember I was like, yeah, I 15 or 16. So I just been allowed to begin purchasing explicit rap music from the store. So essentially anything with the parental advisory sticker on it could not come into my house until Streets Disciple came out. That was the first one where I went to my parents. I was like, can I? And they're like, eh, all right.
You wore them down.
And also by that point I'd had like a DSL hook up at the crib. So I'd like already been downloading a bunch of music and studying stuff for a long time. It was way worse than Sean Price music. So in terms of like problematic content. But yeah, that was like one of the first ones. And I remember I heard Onionhead and Heartburn when they leaked as like the singles, I think. And I knew of Ninth Wonder from the Black Album and the little bit of the listening that I'd heard. So I checked out those two songs on allhiphop.com, on the music player on allhiphop.com. And I remember I listened to Heartburn first, and it was so, like, I liked it, but the beat was not necessarily what I was expecting. But Onionhead absolutely was. I heard Onionhead and like the sample, and it sounded like the dude was like his face, like he was just losing his mind, like he was shaking his head, and they sampled the sound of his voice as he was shaking his head. And the bars on there, for like a 15, 16 year old kid to hear something like, I got a dime chick that live in Japan, black belt, suck, chop bricks with her hand, origato, like just something like that, that just was, you know, brought a chuckle out of me.
Sure.
So yeah, that was how I first encountered it.
Do you think Sean Price is a good storyteller?
I'm really trying to think. I think he's a very good personal, like a memoirist, you know? I think of songs like Brokest Rapper, you know.
Yeah.
It's a good way
like
to put
that
it.
Song is like,
yeah.
It's devastating. Like on the surface, it's very like, hey, you know, I'm just poking fun of myself. But then beneath the surface, he's saying stuff like, it's Father's Day and I ain't get shit from none of my kids. Like,
yeah.
Things like that, which could be taken as like a humorous way of looking at something that's real sad.
Sure.
Yeah.
I think he's really good at that.
Listen, it goes. Frederick Douglass, Nat Turner, Ku Klux Klan, Big Black Burner. Ashtray, cigarette butts, box cutter, gym star, watch this nigga get cut. $10, two tokens, friends hollering, yo. What you smoking? I reply with none of your biz. It's Father's Day and I ain't get shit from none of my kids. Listen, liquor store, let me get the fifth. Weed spots, let me get the spliff. Mad as hell, plus I'm frustrated. Last album came out, you motherfuckers hated. Rock solo, ruck broke. Here's $100, what a fucking joke. Eviction notice, yo, I gotta go. Album been out 2 months, ain't did a fucking show. Ruckus, you ruined. I put the barrel to my dome, but what the fuck are you doing? Chill. Found a new way to build. Fuck rap, started selling two ways and pills. When the stomach growls, and the fridge bare, and you're starving, and your kids there.
I don't really know. Apart from that one Grinch rap he did, I'm kind of struggling to think of a Sean Price storytelling rap. He was, you know what? He was in Helter Skelter. The Nocturnal album had the therapy joint on it.
Right.
That was a storytelling song. That one was really dope. And yeah, he's definitely done conceptual joints in the past, but I think by the time Monkey Bars came out, and there were some conceptual joints on here too, like Jail Shit, but I think he's very good at telling his story.
Yeah.
That would have been a much more succinct way of saying that. Yeah. He's very good at telling his story. For sure.
I agree. Yeah.
I love the Brokest Rapper, you know, when he goes there. I'm thinking of Boombayé. He says, Sean Price always broker than most. That's why the gun smoke choking y'all folks.
Yeah.
That is behind every stick up song that's ever been made, right? Like people coming from poverty, and that's the motivation for the crime. But nobody talks about that, you know?
Right.
And him like alluding to that, I just always thought was great.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, P was like pure unadulterated. He reminds me a lot of, I've been thinking about this the past couple of days too, like his stand-up comedian parallel is somebody like Patrice O'Neal, right? Where it's like, P is gonna say something really funny. It's gonna be like well-crafted and technically sound, but he's gonna also say something to make you question why you laughed at it.
Yeah.
And it's also so sincere. There's nothing in between Sean Price and the record, apart from him like sitting down and writing the rhymes. Everything that you hear on those songs, if it's not him, it's a reflection of his sense of humor. Because he's also like talked about lying in some of his raps before, because he had like a real, he has a real dark sense of humor. But it's all sincerely him. So I think that that's what's so endearing to me about him. And also, he could rap his ass off, just like one of the most adept MCs ever. But beneath all of that is the stuff that you're talking about, Rob, because he's somebody who also has been a victim of those institutions and of that system.
Right.
So of course that's going to come out when you're that sincere. Like, you know, it's going to be a reasoning too. It's not just going to be what you're doing.
Yeah. Sure. I think it's a talent to be able to do that, to be able to talk about something in a way, like you just said, that makes you laugh, but also makes you question things and questions reality. Like, I'm thinking about, like, you named that comedian, I forget what the comedian's name was, but I'm also thinking about like Paul Mooney did that.
Yeah.
Like, he would make jokes about shit, and this shit would be funny, but it would be like, oh, actually that's true. Like, and that's some deep real shit. So I think that's a talent to be able to do that, the delivery. I don't think everybody could do that.
Yeah, I think so. I don't think so either. But he cloaks it in such good rapping.
Yeah.
Like, even if you think about that line that you quoted, like the internal rhyming, the syllables, all that, that you miss it, but it rewards repeat listening, because then you come back to it and it enhances your understanding of where he's really coming from.
Yeah, that's right.
Favorite bars on Monkey Bars.
All right. How much time we got? All right. Favorite bars. I mean, that whole second verse on the title track, boot camp hat on, woo wear shirt, Funk Master Flex lugs looking like a fucking jerk. Yeah. That's a great one. Yes. I love that one. What do you say? No money, nose runny, clothes bummy. Bent Metro card, 4-4 blow dummies. Like, just the rock, like all of the rhyming he's doing on there is crazy. And I think that's part of what I loved about him too, is like, Peele just have like these little throw. Oh yeah, yeah. What else was it? He was like, you know how I met her, broke up and got back together, then broke up and got back together. Psh, you know what I mean? Or like, remember way back when you kicked me out the house? Wait a minute, that was yesterday, right? Like,
yeah,
like,
yeah, yeah.
Like these little asides are like he's just so good at that, man. First name Sean, last name Price. Lyrically, I'm David Ruffin in the flesh.
Mm-hmm.
Like joints like that. Like, he's a funny dude. I would need to pull the lyrics up. Maybe I should have taken notes. or most of like my favorite bars, I'm not gonna say ever out my mouth.
Mm.
So that's part of it too. P is definitely one of my favorites for sure. And there are definitely so many bars on this album that I'm like, there's like a log jam. Oh yeah, might smack off half your smile, go to court in the suit and smack the other half after trial. That's a good one. I like that one.
Yeah.
The bar about something beating the case unless the judge is whack and the jury is jive. Like, just like little, like, all right, hold on. I got to look up more bars. This is killing me. I got to pull these lyrics up. Definitely a lot of favorite bars. But the first one that comes to mind is the woo wear hat on, Funk Flex shirt.
Yeah.
You know, like, mm-hmm. That's one of my favorites ever. I love that line.
I feel like he sums up his whole aesthetic and style when he says, y'all be rhyming about nothing. I rhyme about nothing and it sound like something. Like, that's true. That's it.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Or like him just starting verses like Benjamin Banneker, Africa Bambaataa, like
just random
verse. That's how the verse starts.
Yeah.
Two names. Oh yeah, yeah. You think you nice, but I know somebody hotter with the crackhead mother and a piece of shit father. And then he goes, Sean P. Right.
So good.
Also, the other one, now it's coming back to me. The other one I love is my friends telling me the boot camp whack. Fuck you, Pa. You can't rap. Like that, like the just stuff like that.
Yeah.
Not like you can't, you know, just Man. We're going to be here all night if I got to keep looking through these bars, so I should probably chill. But yeah, those are the ones that come to mind for sure.
Those are great. All of them.
Mm-hmm.
Do you guys rock with the album? Did you guys enjoy it? Or was it? Okay. All right. I
love Sean Price. I mean, okay. I'm not as, a, I'm not as big as a fan as you are. Like, I'm not, I feel like you're like a number one fan, but I think he was really gifted for the reasons that I explained earlier. But yeah, he's also fucking funny.
Right.
So it's funny. Always entertaining to listen to him for me.
Yeah.
So my favorite album is Mike Tyson, though.
Oh yeah, Mike Tyson is crazy.
Yeah, the beats on that shit are woo.
That title track on Mike Tyson is nasty.
Yes.
The title track beat on there is nasty. Also, Throw You Under a Bus. Something about Throw You Under a Bus, Fucker, I'll Throw You Under a Van. Throw the van in reverse and then do it again.
Yeah.
All over that album for sure.
Yeah, I love that album.
It's 1A, 1B, 1C. And you guys already talked about Jesus Price with Alexander Richter. So,
another good one.
It was hard. I'm going to wind up talking about three different albums on here.
So Nonfiction.
Yeah.
You were saying Nonfiction served as like a compass of sorts, at least sonically, or as far as feeling goes, for the Gollum of Brooklyn.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, those guys were my first reference points for Jewish rappers who are not the Beastie Boys or parody rappers.
Hmm.
Nonfiction, they were just some guys from Brooklyn who were hip hop heads and loved rhyming, and loved hip hop and were really good at it. And a lot of the stuff that they would pull from would be occasionally like Jewish folklore, like Jewish references to the Torah, references to Judaism that would show up in their music. And it would be really relatable to me. So yeah, I mean, definitely that album, The Future Is Now, and just Ill Bill, I think as a rapper for me is very, and Gore-Tex too, to an extent, or Lord Gore or Lord Goat. I forget what he's called now.
Lord Goat. You
got it. But, yeah. But he, like his voice too, super raspy, but like always kind of came through with these crazy references that I would never think of, but it still sounded sincere. And the rhymes were still really dope. Like them name dropping Menachem Begin in a song. It was like, okay, I've seen that name on my father's bookshelf. I would never think to put it in a rap, but it's kind of cool.
Also want to give you a moment to say something about the Sean Price mixtape that you sent us for extra credit listening. Donkey Sean Jr. I don't think I've ever heard this before, honestly. And I'll admit I didn't listen to the whole thing. I didn't have time to get all the way through it. So maybe I'll only get half extra credit. But just want to give you an opportunity to speak on it. Like, what was it for you that like stood out?
Just his, like the freestyles he did on there.
Yeah.
And you could tell it's definitely like, in order to promote the album, let's get everything that we have on a burn CD onto one burn CD and then, and then have PF cut and blend it all together. But it was, I mean, Eminem's nice, but Eminem's white. It's my time, right? Like just there are just so many moments like that where it felt very much like he was, again, right? Like it was before he really grew into the rapper he became, like this kind of bulletproof, invincible dude, to be able to hear him really just enjoying rhyming and being a rapper and like being funny and having personality and like getting stuff off his chest with some of the songs from Monkey Bars. It was cool. It's just cool to be able to get that kind of insight into the headspace of your favorite rapper in their earlier recordings, right? Or at least in his case, earlier solo recordings. So yeah, it was dope. It was really dope. That's what I like.
It's a really good mixtape.
Yeah,
it is. It is.
I especially liked the Helter Skelter Triumph.
Yeah.
Triumph song that's on there.
That was fun. Ashaun Atomically.
Yes. Well, Def C, thanks so much for sitting down with us and talking through these serious moments and also enjoying the fun ones with us. Really appreciate you.
Yeah, no doubt. Thank you guys. I appreciate you.
Absolutely.
I'm not a Jewish person, but I personally, and although I haven't read the book, I personally think what you've done here with this project is really important, really significant. So I'm excited for folks to hear it. I hope everybody will read the book and find the soundtrack and take something from it.
Yeah, I hope so too, man. I hope so too. Thank you. Thank you for real. Thank you both.
Sure. Yeah. Is there anything you want folks to know about where to buy soundtrack, physicals, anything like that?
It'll be on all digital streaming platforms on September 29th. If people want to support it directly, defc.bandcamp.com. The book, I believe, is available from the publisher, Penguin One World. It's called The Golem of Brooklyn, a novel. It's very, very well done. I hope everybody runs out, buys it. Even if you don't, listen to the mixtape. At the very least, I hope you read the novel because it's an important one. It's hilarious. And it also is saying something very important at a time when it needs to be said. So, yeah, great. I think that's pretty much it.
That's great. All right, Def C, thanks again. Really appreciate you. Really appreciate your time. This has been The Next Movement, folks. Thanks for listening. Peace.
I was high enough to play God. Then the hits just kept on coming. I'm not Wade Boggs. I'm not even a single A player. I got the job security of a rich girl's waist trainer. Clay lurching from my closet, hauled it to the garden. Bled on its veins, prayed it hardened. Into a goblin, gray face. Its features are odd, neither of its knees or arms the same shape. Maybe this'll be a masterpiece once I sober up, or maybe its quality of life's best is a swollen lump. Started hundreds of novels, then quit. Figure I'd make more money throwing art shows for kids. Problem is, they're wealthy heirs with stock tips. I can't tell them what to do from inside of their parents' pockets. Still went wrong trying to do more right. Idle hands cradling a too small life. 9 to 5 shadow cast in New York's heights. Burning sorrows inside of a Newport light. Now I do dumb shit like get stoned and cast spells or take international flights for blackmail. Committed illicit theft from the school. Cop weed from Wiley and some edibles too. Scrawled Emmett in the forehead of a goon. Waited for it to awaken and then at the second it moved, I leapt back. Even with everything that I read, I didn't expect that. I should probably run, right? It's moved. And it broke my couch.